Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. Joining us right now is Jordan Flaherty, editor of Left Turn Magazine and community organizer with the New Orleans Network, an organization that was founded post-Katrina to build connections amongst different grassroots organizations in New Orleans and to connect outside supporters to the different organizing effects. Welcome, Jordan.
Hi, thank you for having me, and thanks for keeping the focus on what's happening in New Orleans.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important, particularly as we're approaching August 29th, and with majority of the city still not inside New Orleans, I think it's important for progressive and left organizations to do what they can. I think what we're trying to focus on today, I know you've written a lot post-Katrina and during the storm about what's been going on in New Orleans. Your recent work in Alternet was rethinking New Orleans schools. You started off by saying that in New Orleans prior to the storm and displacement, there are 128 public schools, 4,000 teachers, and 60,000 students. So can you talk a little bit about what was the state of the school system then? And now as we're seeing the first wave of schools beginning to open, what's changed?
Well, the school system definitely was in crisis. You had a lot of kids had ROTC, junior ROTC, the military recruiting program, as a mandatory class just because the schools had so little money for elective classes that they didn't have other classes available. You had some of the lowest teacher salaries in the country. You had, just the pure infrastructure of the schools deteriorating. You had crumbling ceilings, peeling paint on the walls, lead paint on the walls, crumbling institutions, horribly low test scores, massive dropout rates. But what you've seen now is, I think, a step that may become even worse for the students most in danger. What you have is, first of all, most folks are still dispersed all around the country and having trouble getting back. They're expecting maybe at most 30,000 kids back, down from that 60,000 previously. So at most half of the kids they're expecting to be back. And for those that are back, they're entering a mostly charter school system. So instead of 128 public schools under the school board, you're going to have about 35 schools. 30 of them will be charter schools, and 5 of them will be under the public school system. And so it's a massive change in the system. What it means is that instead of a school board and a school superintendent responsible for 128 schools, they're going to be responsible for 5 schools. And the rest of these charter schools are not going to be really responsible to anyone other than some minimum guidelines they have to meet. And some of them will probably be excellent schools and some of them may not be. But for parents that are able to navigate the bureaucracy, or able to actively advocate for their kids, those kids are going to be able to get a good education. But for kids who don't have parents that are out there actively advocating for them, applying right now to the different schools, researching which are the best schools, trying to get them in the best schools, those kids are very likely to be left behind. You had already in the spring semester, we had about 12,000 kids back, and estimates were that 1 to 2,000 of them had no school at all. They had no school at all. And that's, previously in New Orleans, what would happen is on the first day of school, a lot of kids wouldn't be registered in any school, and they would just show up at their neighborhood school, and they would be accommodated at that school. Now, most of these schools have no responsibility to accept these kids. So if kids are not enrolled in a school, they may just have no school for them at all. There's no neighborhood school in their neighborhood necessarily because so many of the schools are closed down. So you have a possibility of thousands of kids with absolutely no school, and there's no responsibility of any of these schools to accept the kids.
And how did this process come about? I understand that the governor, Kathleen Blanco, pushed a measure through the legislature that had the state take over 100 of those 128 schools. What was the process that led to now 30 of the 35 schools that are going to be open moving into the charter process?
Well, in this charter system, it's interesting because it doesn't break down on purely left-right lines. You have a lot of progressive people, I think, that embrace charters because they feel it's a path for local community control of their schools. And in some cases, that's true. But at the same time, it's also a path towards the privatization of schools, towards lack of democratic control over schools. It's a path towards corporatization of schools. It's a path to all of those things as well. So people widely recognized that the school system was in crisis, and then suddenly you had all the students were gone, all the parents were gone, all of the teachers were gone, everyone was gone, and so they could completely remake the system. There was nobody that they had to struggle with. The entire staff of the teachers union, which was the largest and most powerful union in the city, was laid off. You had something like 7,000 employees, and all but 61 of them were laid off. So none of those employees have their union anymore. That union is completely eliminated. None of them have their seniority. None of them have their benefits. None of them have jobs anymore unless they've been rehired without their union at one of the new schools. So, you know, it's a completely new system. And, again, some of these schools, they may see improvements, but the fact is that this happened without any input from parents, without any input from families, without any input from the people working in the schools. With everyone gone, the state was able to pretty much just make these changes all on their own.
So you're listening to Jordan Flattery on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. This is Damon Azali with Tim Banglu. And Jordan, the question I have for you in terms of the 35 stools that are going to be open, how many of the 12,000 students will be able to go to it? Because it seems like they might actually even be able to be served by such a small number of schools.
Well, first of all, so 12,000 in the spring. Now, nobody knows how many students will be back for the fall, but they think it'll be up to 30,000. And, yeah, exactly, how many will be able to be open? And, you know, there's several above that 35 that the state is saying that they might try and open. And, you know, here it is weeks before. Nobody knows how many students will be back. They just started hiring teachers at a lot of these schools about a week ago. Literally about a week ago, they started the hiring at some of these schools.
And these without a contract, right?
You know, without a union contract,
right,
anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, so things are really in flux. Things are really a mystery. The state and the city are not really actively trying to find out who will be back and how many people will be back, and putting that information out there for parents. Again, for parents who can advocate for their kids actively, they are really out there. And there's this, you know, kind of glowing article in our local paper, the Times-Picayune, about how, you know, parents can really do smart shopping now and go out, and it's a whole new model, and, you know, kind of extolling the virtues of the free market system, how people will be able to do all this smart shopping. But, you know, the point is, for people that aren't, you know, smart school shoppers, what do they have left? And that's the big question. I don't think anyone knows the answer right now.
So of the schools, of the previous 128 schools, almost 98% of them served Black families, right, and Black children. And we're talking about a system where, after Brown versus the Board of Education, a lot of the white families moved to private schools, to charter schools, and took along with them the tax base. So these 30 schools that are now being, that are resurfacing and rebuilt, what are we talking about in terms of the 30,000 kids? Are we, mainly Black? Are they the middle class kids that are able to come back? And where are the low, no wage workers? Where are the kids below the poverty line, and who's going to serve them?
Yeah, you're absolutely right to bring this up. It's a very racialized tragedy. It's definitely mostly Black kids that are going to be left out of this. And definitely, even a lot of Black families had really pulled their kids out of the public school system and put them into mostly Catholic schools or other religious schools, because the system was definitely in crisis and failing. And so even, you know, a lot of middle class or wealthier Black families had pulled their kids out. But for most of the folks remaining are poor Black families, you know, and there's some of the, again, for some of the bear schools, some of the magnet schools, you know, that's where you have some of the kids from wealthier families, whether Black or white. But definitely the kids that are going to be mostly left out are going to be Black kids from poor families. You know, and again, with parents that aren't able to advocate for them with maybe troubles at home or, you know, other problems in their home life. Those are the kids that are going to be left out, and very potentially thousands of them. And, you know, part of this is also part of this, in general, attack on Black folks in the city. So you have this union, the teachers union, overwhelmingly Black, middle-class Black folks, you know, with, again, health insurance, union protection, seniority. Those folks have all been fired, all lost their jobs, all lost their union protection, another obstacle towards, you know, even middle-class Black folks coming back. And there have just been so many obstacles put in the way of people coming back to the city, and especially in the way of Black people coming back to the city. And it, you know, I mean, it's amazing as many people have come back as they have, and it's a testament to how important community is to people, how much people really want to fight for the city. And it has been inspiring to me how much people are fighting. People are fighting around the school issue. People are fighting in neighborhood meetings and school board meetings. People are out there and fighting and struggling and organizing, and it has been very inspiring to see that.
So who are the folks that they're actually that they're pushing against and have demands against? Is it Ray Nagin? Is it the school board? Like, what are the targets of this to actually get changes in terms of the system?
You know, overwhelmingly, it is the governor, because the state are the ones that seize the schools and then put them into this charter system. So it's the governor that has the most control over it. And that's the main target on it. But, you know, overall, and anybody that's struggling is struggling on many of these points all at once. You know, this whole planning system is in general also a crisis. Even people that are out there working out every day are really confused as to what will happen. Will there be one central plan for the city? Will there be different plans for every neighborhood? If people come back, if people rebuild their homes, will anyone else be back on their block? Will their block be scheduled for demolition? All of these things are still, a year later, still very much an open question, still unresolved for folks, especially in areas that were devastated, in Gentilly, in the Lower Ninth Ward. Majority black areas have been devastated. There's still so many open questions. But people are out there and struggling and fighting and really trying to fight for justice for the city and to fight for the city to come back.
Jordan, can you talk about some of those groups who have been at the forefront of the struggle and the union that's now been dismantled? What are a lot of the workers back in New Orleans, and where have their voices been in terms of trying to struggle against this move to, one, break the union, and two, this privatization and then the corporatization of these schools?
Well, you know, I think that most of the teachers that were members of that union have not been able to come back. They've lost their job. They've lost their home. You know, they've lost so much. I think a lot of them have been kept from coming back. Those that are back are fighting or struggling. You know, some of them have taken jobs at the same school at which they used to work at, but, you know, without the same benefits they had, probably at a lower salary than what they had, without the union protection they had. Some of the organizations that are out there fighting are People's Hurricane Relief Fund, the People's Organizing Committee. Both of those are organizations that have been fighting on the grassroots, organizing people, working in coalition with organizations. Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, has been organizing a Women of Color Clinic and Resource Center, which is so important too. There's so little health care in the city for folks, especially poor folks. You have Safe Streets Strong Communities, which has been working on criminal justice issues, really impressive, important coalition that's combining grassroots organizing with fighting in the legislature, really incredible group of organizers. They've already completely won overwhelming changes in the Indigent Defense Board. The Indigent Defense System was in crisis in the city. You had people going a year or more without getting a trial, without having any representation, sitting in jail for a year, not convicted of any crime. And, of course, during the hurricane, you had 6,000 people in Orleans Parish Prison, our city jail, many of them, if not most of them, just serving misdemeanor, hadn't been convicted yet. It's the city jail, so many of them had just been picked up the previous day for parking tickets, for drunk driving, for drunk walking, you know, drunk in public, you know, minor offenses. One kid they found, he'd been in there for riding his bike one-handed. And most of these folks end up spending months in prison because the jail flooded. They were then evacuated to upstate prisons. They were then basically lost in the system. The defense attorneys had all been fired because there was no money for them either. And people were just lost in the system. Thousands of people with no trial, no lawyers advocating for them, completely lost in the system. So Safe Streets Strong Communities has been fighting on that struggle. There's a workers' justice coalition that's been organizing among not only black workers like the teachers that have been laid off, but also the Latino workers, the day laborers that have been brought in, and really bring up this issue of how black and Latino workers have been pitted against each other in this new city, how everyone from the mayor to the media has been pitting these groups of workers against each other. by putting this message out to black workers, you know, look at these Latino workers, they're going to take your job, they're going to do your job, and telling the Latino workers, look, these black folks are too lazy, they don't want these jobs. You know, basically really trying to pit these workers against each other and robbing both of them at the same time.
So this is Damon Azali with Tambang Lu, and you're listening to Voices from the Front Lines, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and we're on the phone with Jordan Flattery. And Jordan, one of the things that I was just wanted to ask you in relation to the criminal justice system, I know you also do work with critical resistance. In terms of the actual schooling and not all the schools opening and whatnot, what are the connections in terms of the criminal justice system for juveniles and for youth in terms of that mix?
It's so connected. And one of the organizations that's part of Safe Streets, Strong Communities is Juvenile Justice Project of Louisiana, and also Families and Friends of Louisiana's Incarcerated Children, two great grassroots groups that have been working on this issue. You have a lot of these schools had really been functioning as warehousing programs, basically directly shipping these kids off to youth prisons. You had Tallulah Prison, which was a state prison for youth that was incredibly abusive. Amnesty International did a report on it, and they were able to successfully close down that prison. But, right now you have a lot of this demonization of the youth in the city. They just instituted a curfew for youth. The police have been picking up a lot of these kids, and their policy is to pick up the kids and then take them to their parents, and now they found a lot of the kids that are back and their parents aren't back. Their family is in Houston, and the kids came back, and they were going to come back and try and go to school or get a job, and maybe that worked out for them and maybe not. So the police have picked them up, and they're there without their families. For the youth of the city, there's a lot of issues and a lot of needs that the youth have.
Yeah, I mean, because a lot of times in terms of if you look at Los Angeles, the whole stuff around truancy laws and if you're not at school during a particular time, I could imagine that would also be a similar thing if police officers in an already super militarized place would basically be targeting a lot of the youth and saying, oh, we couldn't get you before, but here's the new gang database. So
absolutely. And, you know, again, you've got the National Guard still patrolling the streets here. To have the National Guard and police out on the streets, it's a very, very militarized climate that you have. And the people of New Orleans have been extremely criminalized right now.
While we're at just talking about what's been going on inside New Orleans, I read an article in the New Orleans City Business about New Orleans race relations crumbling under post-Katrina. That's the title, but we all know that race relations were highlighted after Katrina, so we saw the conditions of black folks. But it talked about all kinds of things that are happening. I mean, graffiti telling people to go back to Houston. We having interviews with someone saying in the first few days after Katrina, this guy from Tulane University said he met a lot of white folks who felt Katrina was the best thing that ever happened to New Orleans, quoting that it destroyed the black community and in one fell swoop eliminated crime, poverty, problems of the schools, and burden on the social services. Have you seen a rise in this type of racism in the streets?
I mean, I think, you know, we even saw it right in that mayor's race, right? So Nagin came out and said something fairly reasonable, which was that New Orleans should be a chocolate city again. You know, basically New Orleans should be a majority black city again. And the only problem with that was really that he was not telling the truth. He wasn't really fighting for the city to be majority black. But white people from the city, especially the white elites of the city, really took offense at this. And Nagin, who had been the white candidate, was really demonized. And he saw all over town all these white folks, you know, wearing these T-shirts, you know, saying Vanilla City, saying, you know, I don't want a chocolate city. Basically, this message of really sort of celebrating black folks being gone from the city. And, you know, that was all over the city. And I think that really contributed to black folks really pulling behind Nagin, because the really racist nature of the attacks that were coming out at him. And, you know, living here, I mean, you just really felt that this real hostility from white folks, you know, white folks really almost celebrating the idea of it becoming a white majority city again. You really felt that, you know, it's like they wanted just enough black folks for, you know, some of the flavor of the city. But yeah, you really felt like people were celebrating, black folks not being black. People were kind of salivating at the opportunity of it.
And I think that what that makes the demand of the right of return so central to reconstruction of New Orleans.
I mean, you know, I think one thing that I feel like people around the country, you know, don't recognize with this right of return. I feel like, you know, there's this conversation that says, you know, people in the U.S. move around all the time. What does it matter if people are spread out? You know, we're all in the same country. It's not like they're being shipped to other countries. But New Orleans is such a specific culture, you know, and it's a culture that's contributed so much to this country and this world. This jazz and second lines and jazz funerals and Mardi Gras and these Mardi Gras traditions, the social aid and pleasure clubs, and even newer things, you know, bounce hip-hop, all of these things that came out of New Orleans, that came out of specifically this community, you know, not individuals that created it, but a whole community that created this culture and that sustained this culture. And the people that created this culture and sustained this culture have gotten very little of the financial profit of it. And also, if you look at the economic contributions of New Orleans to the country, something like 40% of the oil from the U.S. Comes out of the Gulf through Louisiana. You have something like 30-40% of the seafood comes out of there. Massive amounts of economic benefits for the country. And again, the people of the city have seen very little of it and have been totally left out of it. And now we're seeing a real danger of the loss of this culture, of this culture being spread around. And, you know, the contributions that this culture has made really being lost, and the people that have created this culture really being robbed, really being criminalized and being robbed and being neglected and being ignored. All these news stories of, people that spend some of their FEMA check on, you know, whatever, on alcohol or on visits to a strip club or whatever people did, you know, but nobody's talking about the billions of dollars that Halliburton stole and you know, the money that they got for reconstruction of the city. Nobody's talking about Blackwater Security and the money that they got to be patrolling around the city. Nobody's talking about the billions of dollars, but people want to micromanage how people spent the $100 or $200 or $300 that they got or $1,000 or whatever while they were in grief, while their home was destroyed, while their family was missing. Such a criminalization and demonization of the people of the city, and it breaks my heart. It really does.
Mm.
Jordan, is there, I mean, a lot of the, just what you particularly said, I think a lot of it to me calls to the mind of reparations, because the people who are affected, I mean, even a lot of your work you're talking about, it comes from the historical Jim Crow before that, et cetera. So are there actually demands around reparations for black folks and saying, you know, $200-$300 isn't enough and really we need reparations, more money, but then also more infrastructure in terms of social safety net? Is that being talked about?
I have heard some people saying that, especially folks from the African American Leadership Project, the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, People's Hurricane Relief Fund, People's Organizing Committee, some of these grassroots black-led community-based organizations that have been out there and organizing. And, you know, I mean, again, you're absolutely right. You know, it so much dates back to the history of the city. And as, you know, this was a huge center of the slave trade in the South. The black folks, again, you know, they built this city, they built this culture that, you know, they built so much, and that, you know, most of this was stolen from the folks of the city. And again, people are continuing to being robbed. And yeah, it's a history that goes back hundreds of years. And without looking at it in that bigger picture and in that bigger analysis, you're missing a lot of it.
Well, thank you so much, Jordan Flattery, editor for Left Turn Magazine and community organizer with New Orleans Network. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Ai-Jen Poo from the Domestic Workers Union in New York City.